and Triton Construction versus Eastern Shore. Are you ready to proceed? Mr. Bestie, good afternoon.
May it please the Court, Robert Bestie on behalf of Appellant Triton Construction Company. Your Honor, with the permission of the Court, if I may introduce Jonathan Landisman, my partner from our Philadelphia office. He's been admitted pro hac vis in this matter, and with the Court's permission, I would ask that he be permitted to conduct argument today.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn on the clock, and you'll start with a total of 20 minutes and a green light. You've reserved 5 minutes. When you either see 5 minutes or the orange light, you can continue, but you'll be using the time you reserved.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, as Mr. Bestie just noted, my name is John Landisman, and I represent the plaintiff below appellant, Triton Construction Company. In this case, the Chancery Court issued a final order and judgment after a 4-day trial. That judgment was issued on June 8th in the amount of $167,000 against the defendants below. Triton has filed an appeal in this matter, and the defendants below have filed a cross-appeal. Triton's appeal raises only one issue, and that issue is whether a party that knowingly participates in a breach of fiduciary duty may retain the profits it realized as a result of its wrongful conduct. That is the single issue that is raised in Triton's appeal. There are two issues raised by the cross appeal, and I will address those later during this argument. Turning to the first issue concerning the equitable remedy of disgorgement, this is a question of law which should be reviewed by this Court on a de novo review standard. The facts that relate to this issue are disturbing. Tom Kirk, the defendant, was hired as an estimator slash project manager by Triton Construction Company in February of 2004. He worked full-time for Triton, and his primary job responsibility was to prepare bids and estimates for Triton. Unbeknownst to Triton, beginning in November of 2005 and commencing for a period of 22 months thereafter, Tom Kirk worked secretly for one of Triton's direct competitors, Eastern Shore Electrical Services. And he was working secretly with Eastern, performing...
Mr. Landisman, I think you can assume that we're all familiar with the facts, and I don't think that there seems to be much dispute on about the master facts from either side. So as far as, you know, from my perspective, I would like to get your views, have you express your views on the issue that you just articulated, which I gather is that Eastern should have been required to disgorge all the profits that it made on, what was it, 180 jobs or 13 jobs, I'm not sure which.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll dispense with the facts then. There were 195 jobs that Kirk bid for Eastern. Of those 195 jobs, he bid the same job for Triton and for Eastern. And of those 13 that were dual bid, I'll call those the dual bid jobs, Eastern won 2, Triton won 1. The Chancery Court found that Eastern realized gross profits of approximately $146,000 on those two projects that were won and entered an award for those two projects in the amount of $146,000.
And then added on to that the $21,000 of salary or hourly fees that Mr. Kirk was paid by Eastern.
That's correct.
And attorney's fees.
Eastern, there was an award for only part of the attorney's fees for a breach of the preliminary injunction that was issued earlier in the case. And the $21,000 that Your Honor had referenced was paid to Kirk by Eastern on an hourly basis,
right,
for the work that he performed.
Is it your position that the court erred in not awarding damages against Eastern on the 13 jobs, or are we talking about all 195?
We're not talking about all 195. Of the 195 that was bid, Eastern won 59 of those jobs, and that 59 jobs represents the profit, or the fruit of the poisonous tree, if you will, that Eastern realized from this conspiracy. And the profit on those 59 jobs was approximately $2.9 million.
And these are jobs on which Triton did not bid.
Of the 59 jobs that Eastern won, Triton had bid on two of them.
All right, but so we're talking about the 57.
The 57 jobs, that's correct, Your Honor.
Triton did not bid on.
The 57 jobs that Triton did not bid on, that Mr. Kirk prepared bids for Eastern while he was working for Triton.
Well, let's go back to your opening statement, which is that the court should have required disgorgement of all profits connected to the breach of fiduciary duty. In this particular case, the vice chancellor concluded that there wasn't an establishment of the nexus, and that's why he denied that. With regard to these 57 jobs, you seem to be contending the fact that he, Kirk, helped Eastern bid at all is the only connection that's necessary to require disgorgement of the profits. Is that correct?
No, that would not be a completely accurate statement, Your Honor.
So connect the breach of fiduciary duty to these 57 bids. Isn't that what you have to do?
Well, there's two causation issues. The one I think that Vice Chancellor Parsons had looked at was whether or not Triton actually lost profits as a result of the work that Kirk performed for Eastern.
Right.
That is one issue, and that issue is, I think, to the extent that the Chancery Court found that there was a reason, or that there needed to be a showing that there would be a loss by Triton, that's inconsistent with Guth and all the other case law that's cited in the briefs that show that disgorgement is appropriate regardless of whether or not the plaintiff actually suffered a loss.
Okay, that's the corporate law disgorgement or fiduciary principle, which you're arguing should apply here, correct?
That's correct.
But here, the relationship between Eastern, the Eastern and Triton had a non-fiduciary relationship, isn't that correct? That
there was no fiduciary relationship between Eastern and Triton, but Eastern and George Elliott, Eastern's president, knowingly participated in Mr. Kirk's breach of fiduciary duty. So when the Chancery Court says, Mr. Kirk, you breached your fiduciary obligation not with respect to only two jobs or not with respect to 13 jobs, but with respect to all 195 jobs, which encompasses the 59 which were awarded to Eastern, and then disgorges the entirety of the $21,000 from Mr. Kirk.
All right. The nexus, then, is that, or at least as you're arguing, is that there was aiding and abetting or conspiring on the part of Eastern with the breach of fiduciary duty that was owed by Mr. Kirk. Is that right?
That's correct. The
okay.
nexus is not that Mr. Elliott and his company, Eastern, were passive and just received.
Okay, I got that. Now, is it your position that the primary wrongdoer, Mr. Kerr, should be liable for $2.9 million?
He should be held jointly and severally liable for the entirety of the profits, which would include the $2.9 million.
All right, so and that would be true even if it's clear, as a matter of fact, that Triton did not bid on the jobs for which there was a $2.9 million profit obtained by Eastern.
Triton did not bid on those, and it would still be true that the answer to your question is yes, that
On what basis do you justify that?
The basis upon which that's justified is there was a conspiracy here. The Chancery Court specifically found that
Let me phrase my question a little better.
Sure.
The cases, the doctrine on which the cases that even your side relies upon speaks of disgorgement of profits flowing from the fiduciary breach. That means that there has to be some causation of some kind in order to measure the extent of the disgorgement. Explain to us what the causation is here that would justify holding Mr. Kirk liable for $2.9 million on projects that his beneficiary, Triton, had no interest in bidding on.
Well,
had no expectancy participating in.
The causation, Your Honor, when we look at the element of causation, is that Mr. Kirk identified, well, he performed this work for Elliott and Eastern, and they did so hand in hand. And but for them working together for 22 months secretly and entering into this conspiracy, Eastern would not have realized all of the profits that they realized. And Eastern's profits, and this is reviewed in the brief, they skyrocketed as soon as this conspiracy took place. And the reason for that, the reason in fact and the reason in law for Eastern realizing all of these increased profits, that additional $2.9 million was Kirk's work with Elliott. That is what resulted in this $2.9 million that they should not be allowed to retain.
So you're saying that the mere fact that Kirk was working for, helping Eastern prepare bids on these jobs in which Triton had no interest, was a breach of fiduciary duty, therefore any profit that Eastern gained would flow from that breach of fiduciary duty, even though it had no impact whatsoever on Triton?
Well, I think to say that it had no impact whatsoever on Triton...
Well, what impact would it have if Triton wasn't interested in bidding? I mean, a lot of the cases that you're citing are corporate opportunity cases where the beneficiary corporation was deprived of an opportunity that it would otherwise have availed itself of. And that's the opposite of what we have here.
I don't think that that's actually, Your Honor, and respectfully consistent with the facts as the Chancery Court set them out. I think the Chancery Court found that Triton and Eastern were direct competitors bidding to many of the same customers in the same geographic area, and the work that Mr. Kirk did Eastern.
You know, since you're talking about fidelity to the trial court's opinion and the facts that were found, the trial court made findings that there were no bids made by Triton on this case, nor was there any expectancy on the part of Triton with, in connection with those 57 projects.
The trial court did find, and I would concede that, Your Honor, the trial court did find that Triton did not have an expectancy in bidding those 57 projects.
So, if your argument is that that Eastern should be, its liability should be coextensive with that of Mr. Kerr, because he was the primary wrongdoer and the conspirator was Eastern.
That's correct, but when we label Mr. Kirk as the primary wrongdoer, really Mr. Elliott and Mr. Kirk worked together hand in hand. These men were meeting in parking lots. They were on the phone 10 times a day.
But the fiduciary here, if there was one, was Mr. Kirk.
The fiduciary
that had the fiduciary duty was Mr. Kirk, not Eastern.
That's correct. The fiduciary was Mr. Kirk. And that leads me actually to the second point, which relates to one of the cross-appeal issues. The argument that has been made in the cross-appeal is to rely upon Brophy and say that Mr. Kirk either did not have fiduciary obligations or that his fiduciary obligations should be construed very narrowly, only to the extent that he had access to confidential information. And we believe that that is inconsistent with fundamental principles of agency law that are well established here in Delaware. An employee, even someone who is not an officer or a director, that nevertheless has a special relation of trust and confidence with the employer, does in fact owe fiduciary obligations to the employer. It is not only the access to confidential information.
Can I interrupt for a second? The description you're giving us, at least to me, makes Mr. Kirk out to be something of a superstar in the sense that he apparently was the one and only estimator who could go to the other side, and suddenly they get 59 jobs that they never would have gotten, never had gotten before. It's all because of him. Is that a finding of the court?
I think that that is consistent with the court's record. Mr. Elliott had just started his company, and he testified that he was working out of his basement and was desperate to get someone in to help him perform estimating work. And but for an increase in estimates, getting estimates out on the street, he wouldn't have been able to increase his company and realize the profits that he did. And Mr. Kirk had bid, I believe the amount of the bids was in excess of $35 million. So when you get those that many bids out on the street, that's what Mr. Elliott and Eastern needed to increase their business. Just to finish up on that second issue, the cross-appeal issue, here the trial court correctly found under agency principles that Mr. Kirk's ability as an estimator to bind the company's assets rendered him a fiduciary, and that there were numerous fiduciary obligations flowing from that relationship, including the duty to refrain from engaging in competitive activities, the duty to refrain from assisting competitors, the duty of disclosure, and that he breached all of those duties. I'll reserve the balance of my time, unless you had another question.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Kelleher.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Bill Kelleher for the appellees and cross-appellants. This Court should be especially aware of the following four factual findings of the trial court. The first, the trial court found that Mr. Kirk was not a key managerial employee of Triton. The trial court also found that Triton did not have an interest in the other 182 projects on which it did not bid. That's a factual finding of the trial court. The trial court also said and found that Triton failed to show that Eastern would have received less revenue or profits if it had hired a different person to perform the part-time work that Kirk performed for Eastern. Even Triton's trial expert conceded that point. In other words, had Eastern gone out and hired anybody with some estimating experience, they could have got the same work done for the same price that they paid Tom Kirk, and they would have been no better off as far as revenue or profit goes.
Can I stop you on that point? Is the record clear that is the record clear that there were other people out there who could have been hired to perform the same services as Mr. Kirk, who were available and who would have done it for the same under the same terms that Mr. Kirk was secretly working for Eastern?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. That came out at trial, and we put on evidence to that effect, and it was really unrebutted. And certainly that's embedded in the trial court's finding in the opinion. And this is page 74 of the trial court's opinion, that Eastern would have received no less revenue or profits had it hired somebody else. There's certainly no a suggestion that this work was something only Tom Kirk could do.
There's a difference between getting bids out so you have a potential to get the contract and getting a bid out that's going to result in an award of the contract. You have to put together a bid that's going to perhaps be the lowest bid, and then if you are awarded the contract, you still need to be able to make a profit. So are you telling us that if we reviewed the trial transcript carefully, we would see that Mr. Kirk had no particular expertise that was going to make him a very astute bidder, and that anybody who could put the numbers together would have put Eastern in the same position that Kirk was able to put them in?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm saying that. But I think I could save the court the trouble and just refer the court to the trial court's opinion, because that information is in there, not in as much detail as it is in the transcripts, of course, but it's in there.
Well, I mean, we've all read the court's opinion carefully, but we're looking for the underlying record support for what's in the opinion. And so you see the distinction I'm making between someone who is a knowledgeable, astute bidder and someone who can put a bid together. And so in response to Justice Berger's question, your answer appears to be there were people with Mr. Kirk's ability that were available and equally expertise that Eastern could have gone to if they didn't go to Kirk.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And in fact, and I don't believe this made it into the trial court's opinion, but certainly it's in the transcripts, there was testimony and unrebutted that there were estimating services that Mr. Elliott and Eastern could have gone to, sort of like part-time lawyer help, you might refer to in the legal world, that could have come in and done this work for very similar to the $20 an hour that Mr. Kirk was charging for his work. And it would have been the same quality of work.
And so, in your view, then, Mr. Kirk wasn't a superstar. And what's the significance of the fact that when he was ultimately hired by your company that he got a $24,000 raise?
Well, the significance is he's a good performer. He's a good estimator, but certainly he has no unique skills. And his salary at Eastern is a good salary. It's about $90,000 a year. He was making about $65,000 at Triton. So those are salaries for someone, in both cases, 65 and 90, an experienced person in the construction industry that has been doing it for a while. But I don't believe there's a superstar numbers, and they're not the type of salary that somebody's going to get who's going to be bringing in millions of dollars because of their unique skills. He did get a raise. Mr. Elliott thinks highly of Mr. Kirk, and he's a hard worker. But it's not our position, and certainly the trial transcript supports it. It's not our position that Mr. Kirk is a superstar. He's unique among estimators. In fact, I'm confident there are dozens, if not hundreds, of people in Delaware that are as qualified as Mr. Kirk in this type of work. The fourth factual finding that I think is important from the trial court is that the trial court found that Mr. Kirk never destroyed or diverted any bidding opportunities that were sent to Triton. In other words, it's not as if he found out about jobs, bidding opportunities while at Triton, and diverted those to Eastern. Eastern bid on those, and Triton never found out about it.
And do you think that information might have been available on the material that Mr. Kirk lost or destroyed?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and here's why. Before Mr. Kirk left, they were able to get a ghost copy of what was on his computer, and that's how they found out about these other 195 part-time projects that he worked on for Eastern. He later, the record certainly suggests that he destroyed some documents right before he left, but they did have that ghost copy, and it would seem that they got everything that he destroyed there in that ghost copy. They also had available to them all his emails on their server. They acknowledged that at trial. They never went back and looked for them. They admitted
to
that.
I thought the problem was with what he was doing out of his house, the thumb drive and the laptop that, he kept at home that were destroyed. Are you saying that the information on those two sources was identical to what was already at Triton?
It's hard to say. Well,
that was my question.
But
you said the record's clear. We have a factual finding that he didn't divert anything. But the record's equally clear that he had separate information that he destroyed, which may or may not have shown that he diverted things.
Well, Your Honor, the trial court did make some adverse inferences against Mr. Kirk. But as far as diversion or destroying bidding opportunities, the trial court made a specific factual finding on that issue, which was that he did not do that. There were some other adverse inference taken against him, but the trial court looked at the evidence, looked at everything that was available, and made a ruling of fact that that did not occur. And there's
let,
one...
Let me get off into something slightly more philosophical, perhaps. The trial court seemed concerned about not forcing your company to disgorge all of its profits from those jobs that it won, that Kirk had participated in, and was concerned that that was punitive. And yet, isn't the underlying rationale for the high standards that are imposed on fiduciaries is the idea that you're not supposed to do what Mr. Kirk did, and that anybody who does business with you and who conspires with you to act in that way ought not to see any benefit from it, because this is not conduct that is considered acceptable business practice. So why shouldn't Eastern be put in a position where, sorry, you know, you knew you were taking somebody else, a competitor's estimator. You could have, at least based upon what you're telling us, you could have gone and found somebody equally good elsewhere and not had any problems. But instead, you chose to do something that was improper, and now you're going to have to pay for it.
Well, Your Honor, I think as to the 13 commonly bid projects, I think that argument may be a fairly strong one, but not as to the other 182 projects on which Eastern and Triton did not commonly bid. Because all Eastern did was hire someone part-time to do work for them. Their intentions, and I think the trial court's opinion is clear on this, wasn't to use the secrets in all those jobs to somehow hire Mr. Kirk in an effort to find out what's going on at Triton and utilize Triton secrets in making their bids. And it wasn't Eastern's intention, at least as to the other 182 jobs, to be antagonistic to Triton, and it wasn't Mr. Kirk's intention either. So If you're going to hire a part-time employee...
Well, he must have had some concern about whether what he was doing was antagonistic, because he never told them, and he went out of his way to do everything surreptitiously. So if this was, you know, one of those completely above-board things, why did he conduct himself the way he did?
Well, he was careless in that regard. He probably thought that they wouldn't like what he was doing. That's probably true. Or at least they possibly wouldn't. He decided not to.
Careless? I think the Court of Chancery and its findings of fact went beyond careless.
As far as the destruction of evidence, yes, Your Honor. I don't mean to diminish that, but I mean just in deciding to do this to begin with and keeping it secret from his employers. But as to the other 182 projects, It shouldn't matter that he kept those secret, because his principal didn't have an interest in that work. The 13 projects on which they commonly bid, whether he meant to do it or not, he knew that he was close to the line, and he was antagonistic, at least in those 13 projects, to his full-time employer.
Well, I know the Court of Chancery dealt with what I'm going to ask you about in the trade secrets part of its opinion, where it concluded most of this was generally known or could be generally known. But putting that aside, even if there's public information, some people are able to marshal the knowledge of the public information in a more successful way than others. And there may be economies of scale in bidding, or there may be other advantages you can see by combining things in certain ways. So going back to Justice Berger's question, if in fact Kirk, in this particular industry, had developed skills that enabled him to be the successful bidder, and Eastern was able to take advantage of that, why shouldn't they be responsible for disgorging the profits that, you know, they realized from engaging Kirk in what was a breach of his fiduciary duties and using that expertise that he had developed as a fiduciary?
Well, he developed it in previous positions, too, and that's in the record. I mean, that happened. People go from job to job to job, and they develop skills in any profession. As long as his full-time employer, Triton, didn't have an interest in those jobs, 182 jobs on which only Eastern bid, that shouldn't be a problem because he happened to have some skills. He was experienced. He got those skills arguably at Triton. He had many of those skills when he showed up at Triton. So they went out and hired somebody to do part-time work for them that had some experience.
Well, maybe the facts could be characterized a little bit differently. Maybe what was going on was that Eastern saw Kirk as being a good man, good at the job, and would be beneficial. Eastern was not in a position to hire him full-time at that point. So the deal was, don't tell your employer, keep working for your employer, but work for us part-time, and then, you know, once we get up and running, then you can move over to us. And in the meantime, we'll have the benefit of somebody that we couldn't afford to hire because, you know, Mr. Kirk isn't going to give up full-time salary for $20 an hour part-time. Doesn't that put a slightly different view on color to what happened here, and isn't that an accurate or reasonably accurate statement of what the facts revealed?
It's reasonably accurate, but the facts also revealed that estimating services were available for such companies that were fledgling and didn't have the desire, need, or ability to hire somebody full-time but could have contracted out the services. I mean, what we're talking about, and the trial court did find this, that Mr. Kirk was doing takeoffs. He looked at blueprints. He made measurements. He counted light fixtures. It's work that could have easily been outsourced to one of these other companies. And again, I go back to, but it's not a problem to hire someone part-time as long as you're not hiring that employee and expecting them to use their secret information in their work that they're doing for you.
Okay, but wait a second. Again, Eastern could have gone out and hired Mr. Glutz and have him paid $20 an hour work part-time. But somebody who's available to do that is not the same as somebody who's doing a good job at a full-time job and is getting paid a decent amount. So it's not entirely accurate to say that, well, because there were other estimators out there, the fact that Eastern used Mr. Kirk really made no difference. Eastern wanted Mr. Kirk because he was one of the better ones, and they couldn't afford to hire him full-time.
Well, Your Honor, the trial court did find, as a factual finding, that Eastern did not benefit in its revenue or profit by hiring Mr. Kirk, as opposed to hiring one of those other agencies or going out and getting somebody else. So,
you mean, are you saying that that Mr. Kirk did not have a unique set of skills such that but for hiring Mr. Kirk on a part-time basis, Eastern would not have realized the profits that it did on the 57 projects in question?
That's right, Your Honor. The trial court found that regardless of who they hired, one of the estimating agencies or Mr. Kirk, it would have made no difference to their bottom line. There was nothing that Mr. Kirk brought to them that somebody else couldn't have, and that was available in the marketplace.
And the court so found?
Yes. That is 74, the trial opinion, page 74.
I'd like to shift gears just for a minute because there is a there. You have two arguments on cross appeal, and the second one has to do with the measurement of profits or lost profits. I believe the gist of the argument is that in these circumstances, it was error for the vice chancellor to use as the measure of Triton's lost profits, the lost profits or the profits that Eastern gained on the two projects for which damages were awarded. And the argument, as I understand it, is that from a legal perspective, the court should have required Triton to, I guess, estimate what its own lost profits would have been. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. Triton effectively, as plaintiff, had two options how it wanted to.
Okay. Well,
sorry.
I have a, my question is, was this argument raised below?
Yes, we brought it. It made it into the trial court's opinion in a footnote, so we did raise it below in our post-trial briefing. We argued for net profits below.
And what did the trial court, how did the trial court deal with that claim?
The trial court dealt with it, I believe it's footnote 171 of the opinion. It's a long footnote. The trial court said, if this had been an equitable claim, like unjust enrichment, the defendants are right. Net profits was the right measure. So they cited to the Fleer case for that and maybe a few other cases. The trial court said, but Triton brought a tortious interference claim. And because tortious interference is a claim at law, Triton is entitled to gross profits. But there's no case that says that. And my position is, if you stand back and look at it, unjust enrichment is focused rightfully on what's the defendant doing, what happened to the defendant, how did they get unjustly enriched, whereas tortious interference is all about what happened to the plaintiff. How were their contracts interfered with? How were their relationships interfered with? So if the focus is on the plaintiff, then the plaintiff has to prove their profits. Triton didn't prove its profits at all, and it relied on Eastern profits. And that's fine. They can do that under unjust enrichment. But if they do that, they're limited to Eastern's net profits. And a few of the cases that were cited in this area, the All-Pro Maids case, the plaintiff proved its own profits there. That's a tortious interference case. Likewise, the Vitex case, the other side cites that on appeal. They cite it to say that they're entitled to gross profits. It's true that gross profits were awarded in the Vitex case, but in that case, the plaintiff proved its own profits under tortious interference.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If it pleases the court. I would ask the court to take a step back and look at this case compared to a lot of the other cases in this area that deal with large publicly traded companies, and keep in mind that this case involves Triton, which is a company that has approximately 30, 35 employees, and Mr. Kirk had a position in that company that involved bidding. There were only two people that were putting bids out for the company. It's critically important in the construction industry. If you don't get the bids right, or if you don't have competitive bids, they're too high, too low, you're not going to get work. He was somebody who was trusted. He was truly a fiduciary, and then he goes out and he works for the competitor. And there's a question about, is he a superstar? Could someone else have performed the work that he performed? With respect to the 13 bids, and this is found by the Chancery Court, with respect to the 13 bids that he bid for both companies, it was noted by the Chancery Court that the bids that he did for Eastern were, the majority of them, slightly lower than the bids that he did for Triton on the same projects. So it shows, or at least that fact would seem to indicate, that he's using his secret information, the confidential information of Triton, for the benefit of Eastern. Also, with respect to that issue, there was testimony at the trial court about Mr. Kirk attending management meetings and having access, again, in this small company environment, having access to things about labor rates, all these different things, and to think that he wasn't using those for the benefit of Eastern in preparing the 195 bids, I think is inconsistent with the record facts. Mr. Kelleher had just made a statement that he's confident that there are dozens of people that could perform the estimating work that Mr. Kirk performed. There was testimony by a witness by the name of Ernest Skaggs in the record, and he was initially identified by the defendants as one of their expert witnesses, but he wound up being a fact witness, and I believe that his testimony was exactly contrary to what Mr. Kelleher just represented to the court. I believe that his testimony was that there are services out there that perform this, but it's not for $20 an hour. It's for something significantly higher, maybe double that amount.
Can you respond to the second argument being made on cross-appeal regarding measurement of profits?
Yes. I think the trial court correctly looked at gross profits and not net profits, relying upon the All-Pro Maids case as well as the expert testimony from Triton's expert, John Wheeler, that there should not be an offset or a deduction for overhead. The idea in fashioning the remedy is not to allow the defendants to recover their overhead, and that's the gist of, I think, the trial court's decision on that issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.